Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. Today we'll look at a number of subjects in the news. We'll begin in a moment and speak with Lieutenant Colonel Karen Kotowski, who up until recently was in the Office of the Secretary of Defence working on policy planning. And she recently wrote an opinion piece that was published in the Houston Chronicle suggesting that the U.S. Foreign policy, in particular in regard to the Iraq War, had been captured in a sense by a cabal, the neoconservative cabal in the Office of the Secretary of Defense, and that from her personal experience, they weren't interested in a diversity of input, particularly conflicting intelligence that didn't comply with their rosy scenario of the Americans liberating Iraq, not unlike in World War II in Paris with people throwing roses on the tanks, etc., and that they had simply not thought this thing through. But we'll be talking about her experiences and how they've contributed to this mess that the United States is now in the Middle East. We'll also talk with the former pollster for President Carter, Pat Caddell. He's both a pollster and a political consultant and a regular on MSNBC. And we'll then, towards the end of the program, we'll talk with Jackie Cabasso, the author of The End of Disarmament and The Arms Race to Come. She is organizing a demonstration outside of the Lawrence Livermore Lab today up there in Northern California. We'll be talking to her from the gates of Lawrence Livermore, where work is beginning on mini-nukes and micro-nukes, a new generation of nuclear weapons that many fear will cross the threshold from deterrence into a usable weapon. And we'll be talking to her about what she is protesting and also the extent to which the United States is building more nuclear weapons at the same time trying to discourage countries like Iran and North Korea from doing so. Let's now go to the subject of the neoconservatives and the extent to which the Pentagon and the American foreign policy establishment, particularly the national security establishment, has been blinded by ideologues. I'm speaking with Lieutenant Colonel Karen Kotowski, who recently retired from the Office of Secretary of Defense, where she was working in the policy planning department of the Pentagon. And you were involved in much of the this theater that the United States is now in Iraq. And you had a piece also recently in the Houston Chronicle suggesting that what you saw there inside the Pentagon was a kind of dysfunctional groupthink. Give me a sense of that, of what your thesis is.
Well, what I saw when I worked in the Pentagon, particularly the 10 months that I spent in the Near East South Asia office, was a viewpoint towards information that if the information didn't fit what we were planning to do, what we wanted to do, what we believed, that information was discounted. Information was acceptable if it came from like-minded people. Information was suspect if it came from either non-like-minded people or members of the traditional bureaucracy, whether that's professional civil service, military, or in the intelligence side of the house.
So does this mean that the civilians, this small group of civilians known as the neoconservatives, could capture the agenda and that they weren't interested in anybody? I mean, what about the rank and file in the Pentagon? Where surely they must have some input.
Yeah, well, in areas that were not of particular concern, you know, we have in Office of Policy, they look at policy, security policy globally, both in regions and functional areas and that kind of thing. If it was an area that the neoconservatives weren't overly concerned with, which is most of the rest of the world outside of the Middle East, I don't think that there was a big, there wasn't anything that you would notice as being unusual. I mean, we have political appointees in the military. I mean, in the Pentagon, those political appointees have political agendas linked with the president who appointed them. That makes sense. I know this because when I worked, prior to joining NISA, I worked in sub-Saharan Africa policy. And in sub-Saharan Africa, the neoconservatives didn't have a lot of interest. In fact, we used to complain that we wish we could get more attention in our sub-Saharan African policy work. from Mr. Fife and from some of these other folks, but we couldn't. When I moved into Near East South Asia, I moved into an area of hot interest amongst the political appointees. And it was a noticeable difference in how that all worked.
Well, it's not as if this group of people, they're very well identified. They've been around Washington for a long time, going back to the Carter days. They were in the Committee on the Present Danger. They were involved in Team B. They were, to some extent, in the Reagan administration, although not at the highest levels. President George Herbert Walker Bush actually kept them at bay. Basically, they didn't have much influence in his administration. During the Clinton years, they were in the wilderness. In fact, there was a joke that in the first Clinton term, you recall when that light plane crashed into the White House?
Oh, yeah.
Somebody suggested that was Jim Woolsey trying to get a meeting.
I hadn't heard that. That's,
yeah.
That's funny.
But anyway, but now they've come back in with a vengeance, as it were, and I don't know whether this is anecdotal, but in the interview that Paul Wolfowitz did in Vanity Fair, he suggested that, I think it was actually Richard Pearl said that what they like about George W. is that there's not, he's kind of an empty vessel and we can fill him.
Oh, my gosh.
And then Wolfowitz in Vanity Fair said, that we basically sold this weapons of mass destruction thing because it was the best, the most accessible to the public.
Sure, the bureaucratic reason that would work the best to achieve
right.
the aim. Yeah.
So give me a sense of why this small group of civilians who are like-minded and who are unquestionably on the same page as the Likud party is in Israel. And that's, I know people think that the minute you say that, you're being anti-Semitic, but that's absurd. I mean, the job before Pearl's job in the Pentagon, he was working directly with Netanyahu. So
yeah, it's true. It's really not absurd to make that statement, to point out the parallels between the Likud party interests and some of the interests of the neoconservatives, but...
And in fact, that's a debate that goes on in Israel because the Israeli Israel is a much more vigorous democracy, arguably, than America is.
And the press is a little more competitive with the story.
Exactly. Yeah.
One thing that I pointed out in the article that you mentioned in the Houston Chronicle and a few other places is that while appointees come in from the president appoints them, and they're going to have a particular agenda that supports what the president is interested in, and that may be different from the previous administration, and it should be. I mean, if we've changed parties or that kind of thing. But in this case, as you point out, the neoconservative folks have been working together and have been developing their particularly foreign policy views for a long period of time, 20, 25 years. They've been in and out they've had influence in and out of previous administrations, and now they have this influence again under George W. Bush. Now, having worked together for such a length of time and knowing each other, developing papers, I mean, many of the famous Project for a New American Century letter to President Clinton, signed by a lot of the same folks running in the Pentagon today, these views that they've held are not just held in the long term, but they've been developed with the same people over that long term. So what you have is a team of folks who work together in the times when they couldn't get meetings, in the times when they were in the wilderness, they stuck together through thick and thin. And now it's thick. Now they have the opportunity to make something happen that they believe in. And so they're working with the same comfort zone, the same people, except now those people have real political power. In the Pentagon, to some extent in the State Department, but less so, and certainly in the Office of the Vice President. These people now, the same group that worked together very comfortably in the wilderness days under Clinton and perhaps Bush the first, now, are empowered. But it's the same people. So they work together through the same channels that they always used. And that's very natural that they would do that. But it does make them very, very effective, and it causes them to discount and leave out people that didn't stay with them during the wilderness. There's a badge of honor earned. I mean, the criticism of Chalabi, in Iraq now. Well, he didn't suffer under Saddam. He left a long time ago, and now he comes back and he says, "Oh, I'm a person who understands Iraqis." Well, Iraqis who stayed there say, "No, you didn't stay here with us during the hard times." Well, that's kind of the same view the neoconservatives have in power today. They only trust the folks that were with them in the bad times. And the folks that are here that can add information, the intelligence community that can provide them with a much broader range of intelligence with which to plan, that's discounted because they're not trusted.
Let me again remind the audience, if I may, I'm speaking with Colonel Karen Kitowski, who was formerly, up until recently, inside the Office of the Secretary of Defense in policy planning. And she had an article recently in the Houston Chronicle criticizing the groupthink, in quotes, that has led us into this Iraq war, where contrary intelligence and viewpoints are discouraged or marginalized. Now, it seems that obviously they wanted this war, they've got this war. And much of it's clear that they had a war plan but not a peace plan. And it's a very, very, I mean, the world is sort of watching America flaying about there. They're desperately trying to get allies to help them out. The Indians promised a division and then they've reneged. Clearly they'd be in better shape if they had Egyptian and Jordanian police. But at a really, at a fundamental level, it seems to me that there's a broader dysfunctionality here in terms of our Middle East policy, which is driven by these neocons, and that is that as you beat up and weaken secular regimes like the Palestinians, the Syrian Baathists, and you destroy the Baathists in Iraq, what inevitably replaces these people are religious fundamentalists. And we have this irony now that all the time that Saddam was in power, the Al-Qaeda had no traction, no presence inside of Iraq. Now the jihadis are pouring in.
Yeah, it's a real, it's ironic, and it's a shame, and it was warned about. It was discussed even in the intelligence community, quietly to these people, and as well as in the press amongst those who were concerned about the run up to war. These things were warned about, and these things were pointed out to them, and yet it didn't really matter because to address a plan for peace or for post occupation. To really think about what that is, to really conduct that, is very expensive in terms of resources. It's a hard sell to the American people. It's just not something American people are interested in hearing about. They have to hear about it now because it's happening, but it's not something that would be easy to sell. It is fraught with complications. It allows for multiple opinions far beyond what the neoconservatives care about. And so it just wasn't convenient. Now it's remarkably expensive and inconvenient, and we're stuck with it. So now Americans will do what we have to do. Ideally, that would be leave, but we're not going to do that. We're gonna muddle through this. I'm sure.
But we're going to take a lot of casualties, aren't we?
Over time, it'll you know, I don't. It's true what you say. I mean, the Jordanian bomb, the bombing of the Jordanian embassy this past week. Is so typical of the kinds of attacks Al-Qaeda is famous for. Certainly, it's the kind of thing that a occupied Iraq is susceptible to now, whereas it wouldn't have been. It wasn't under Saddam. I mean, not, he's an awful guy and an evil guy and a terrible dictator. He's a bad guy. Nobody can defend Saddam Hussein and his regime. But like you said, Al-Qaeda was not operating. In Iraq, even though Osama bin Laden hated Saddam Hussein greatly. It was public knowledge that he had contempt for Saddam as both a bad Muslim, possibly an atheist, and also the secular state concept that you mentioned. I mean,
he referred to him as a socialist.
Yes, he really. If Saddam Hussein had, if Osama had had the resources and the wherewithal. Saddam was one of his enemies as well. In fact, it's interesting that Bush and Osama, in the displacement of Saddam Hussein's regime, are on the same side in this one case. And certainly, Osama bin Laden's concerns, issues, supporters, philosophy is made stronger in Iraq now today than it was before. And that's just an unfortunate, predictable, but unfortunate reality.
Colonel Kotasky, inside the rank and file of the Pentagon and in the intelligence community there, surely there must be a understanding that, you know, you people are charged with the national security of protecting and defending the national security of the United States, and you have threat assessments and you figure out who the real bad guys are and who the less than bad guys are. Isn't it pretty clear that Al-Qaeda is you know, they're serial killers. They're out to kill Americans.
Sure, and has made it very clear that not only do they want to do that and still want to do that, they can do that. They've been successful in doing that.
How come we went after this thug that we'd known for a long time?
He was our thug for a while.
Right, and I've seen pictures of Rumsfeld shaking hands with him when he made those deals during the Iran-Iraq War.
Sure. And you know, a lot of the biological stuff that we feel that he still has, whether it's been destroyed or it will be found, I'm not sure, but a lot of that stuff traces right back to Fort Detrick, where we sold it to him when he was on our recipients list, our trusted, one of our guys, against something that we thought was worse in
right.
Iran.
As Henry Kissinger once said, it's a pity in this Iran-Iraq war that both sides can't lose.
Exactly. He said that indeed. I wonder if he's included that in his new book.
But again, give me and the audience some sense of what's happened here with the professionals charged with protecting and defending America and understanding what the real threats are, and this idea that this small political group can completely sidetrack American foreign policy and actually get this country into a war that was unnecessary and looks like it's going to leave us worse off, and we may end up with a failed state. The very thing that President Bush keeps saying is that, you know, if you have failed states like Afghanistan, then they become havens for terrorists.
Mm-hmm. That possibility is there, and if it occurs, if it evolves that way in Iraq, where it meets the criteria of failed state or ungoverned spaces, then indeed, you know, Bush has made the world less secure and not more secure. How this particular relatively small philosophical group with a particular agenda in the Middle East have achieved their aims, I'm not 100% sure. I don't know. I think Congress needs to look into it and ask some questions about how this happened. In the editorial that I wrote, I think they functionally isolated the professional core, the people that could have provided some broader-based input into the assessment of risk that Iraq poses as compared to, say, North Korea, as compared to China, as compared to other kind of Al-Qaeda itself as a diffuse organization. I mean, a lot of the stuff that didn't fit in with what they wanted, they simply didn't ask for that information, or that information was put in the B pile instead of the A pile. Cross-agency cliques, these people are well-organized. They also have a media organization. In fact, it's interesting. There is a public relations company, small public relations company in Washington, D.C., and it's interesting to go to the site of Benador Associates. Benador Associates has a client list, and the client list reads like every famous neocon in Washington that you want, so including those that are in the media, those that are advisors to the administration, and those who are in the administration. So it's very interesting. They have a powerful way of getting their message out, and certainly in the fall, in the run-up to war, in the lead-up to war, the message was Iraq is the major risk to the United States. Now it's interesting to hear now that George Tenet says, well, you know, here's what we really said. Paul Wolfowitz told Laura Ingraham on the radio last week, he said, well, you know, I never really believed that Iraq was behind 9/11. Well, how do you explain why over 50% of the American people thought that Iraq had something to do with 9/11 last September and October timeframe? Because that was what the Washington was telling them. And here we have Paul Wolfowitz saying, well, I never believed that. Well, you know, this is something, there's something going on here. And it's very alarming. It's very concerning. It does tell us how fragile our democracy is. And I think people should wake up.
Well, In politics, the race goes to the swiftest, and the people that are the best organized, you know, win. So,
sure.
I mean, all the, you know, the Arabs always complain about the Israeli lobby and AIPAC. Mm-hmm. Well, they're not doing anything illegal. They're just highly motivated, and,
sure.
and you know, God, these Saudi sheiks have got so much money, they ought to be able to buy Washington, you know.
Yeah, it's true. It's true, actually. If you take politics entirely out of it and just look at what has happened, the best organized, the most focused effort has succeeded. Mm.
But let's try and analyze the end game here, because it seems to me that if there was more input of minority views and a broader spectrum of and a diversity of intelligence input, we wouldn't perhaps be in this mess. I mean, what is it at the end of the day the neocons and the Likudniks want? I mean, I cannot think for a minute that anybody in the United States thinks that you can rest American security interests in the Middle East having Israel as your local enforcer. It's I don't see how that could ever work.
Yeah,
and the more you beat up on Israel's security, the best thing that's happened to Israel has been a peace treaty with Egypt and Jordan. And as they drag out this agony with the Palestinians and pretend to make a deal but won't make a deal, more and more radicalism occurs in the streets in these countries, and you're going to end up with the Muslim Brotherhood running these countries. And boy, if you think the Hamas is bad now, imagine Jordan and Egypt run by the Brotherhood.
Yeah, it's I think the world has gotten more dangerous, and it's certainly gotten more dangerous in the Middle East, even though Saddam is a very bad guy, and now Saddam is not in power anymore. The level of danger has increased. I think what we're going to see, and this is just my opinion, I don't know, but I think what we're going to see over the next months in Washington is a real conflict between the more rational parts of the Bush administration and the neoconservative viewpoint, because the overall objective, you can read Wolfowitz's speeches and Rumsfeld's viewpoints. I mean, the overall objective was to make Middle East a safer place for all the countries. Now, the threats in the Middle East are clearly identified. Iraq certainly was a threat to his own people. He had invaded Kuwait. But Iran and Syria are held to be the states that particularly provide support to anti-American and anti-Israel terrorism. So the idea that Iraq can be used as kind of a positioning, whether military or political, probably both, against the bulwark, against Iran, against Syria, perhaps against Saudi Arabia, this is part of the longer-term plan. The problem is Iraq has gone so badly because of the process leading up to it, the intelligence exclusions and the lack of any minority viewpoints in developing the plan. Because it's gone so badly, now the more rational side of the Bush administration, who's looking at 2004 elections, is saying, hey, what are we going to do here? This could really stop the neocon push forward, because the neocon push forward, Iraq was just kind of like step one. Step two and three hadn't occurred yet, and now there may be a lot of discussion in Washington on how they're going to do that, and I think it's going to be an uncomfortable time, and we'll see how well organized and how the neocons respond. In fact, it's hard to say that they can even maintain the gains, the so-called gains of occupying Iraq, because Iraq is a very difficult place, as the Brits and many other people know. It's a difficult place to occupy, especially now in an age of the Internet, in an age of free media.
Well, look, our soldiers there are having to watch their back every 24 hours a day. I mean, the idea that you can pump oil out of there and all these fantasies about America ending up with Iraqi oil, the stuff can't even get to market. And furthermore, you could never have military bases and project force out of there if you can't have basic security in the streets.
Yeah, that's true. That's reality speaking, and hopefully the Bush administration will wake up to some of those realities and bring in some broader base of people, experts and that kind of thing, to really try to resolve this huge problem that we've gotten ourselves into.
Well, can I ask you in the last minute then, just to address the broader picture of what I would consider to be a dysfunctional and counterintuitive Middle East policy, and that is that our actions encourage and make it easier for religious fundamentalists to thrive given that there's very little democracy in these countries and the only open spaces have been in the mosques. And, you know, you see what happens in Algeria the minute that you have an election, the Islamists get in. And I imagine if they had any elections in any of these countries, and particularly in Iraq, where the Islamists, the Shia majority, would vote the mullahs in, why is it that we are intent on weakening the secular forces, even though they are corrupt, and we don't build democracy through secular forces, but we weaken them and allow fundamentalists to take over?
That's a good question. I don't think we're that intent on democracy. I think that's just a sales pitch. I really don't want democracy. In fact, if you look at what some of the neocons have written, including Richard Perle, I think some sort of, I think they've mentioned for Iraq a Hashemite monarchy, something that would be associated with the United States, lean towards the United States, and yet rule in a way that does not allow a more pure majority rule type democracy to evolve. So I don't think democracy is really what we're interested in. I think we're interested in basically, you know, power, security for our interests. And some of those interests, of course, parallel the interests of the state of Israel, and some don't. But I don't think we're... I think we said one thing, and this is what's difficult about it for George Bush. He has said that he cares about certain things, like democracy and freedom and lack of oppression and the Iraqi people being able to have self-determination and ownership of their resources. He has said that. But in fact, our interest, and the interest of the neoconservatives in particular, has nothing to do with Iraqi democracy. It has nothing to do with Iraqi free choice over how they dispose of their national wealth. It really doesn't have anything to do with that. And that's why secular countries are as vulnerable as non-secular countries, because we're not concerned about American rhetoric. We're concerned about realism and power. And it's an inconsistent message, but that's where we're at. I don't know how else to answer the question, you know, to say that we're hypocritical in our foreign policy. Well, yes.
Well,
we are.
So what else is new?
Yeah, exactly.
I thank you very much for joining us.
Okay, well, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Hello again, I'm Ian Masters, and I was just speaking then with Colonel Karen Kitowski, who up until recently was working in the Office of the Secretary of Defense in policy planning with the neoconservatives who have been in charge of U.S. foreign policy in terms of its Middle East and particularly the Iraq war. I'm now speaking with Pat Caddell, who's a Democratic pollster who worked for President Carter and has been a political consultant and a pollster since then and is a regular on MSNBC. And Pat Caddell, did you think you would witness California politics descending into a kind of reality TV show? Instead of calling it American Idol, maybe we should call it California Idol.
Well, first of all, I'm not a pollster anymore. I gave up being a political consultant just to clear this record. I left that business a while back, but I'm certainly involved in it. But I was the first person suggested this actually the Friday after the election on Bill Rosenthal's show when I was analyzing the election results in the L.A. Times exit poll. And I said on that show that I thought, given the fact that so many, basically many progressive voters, particularly minority voters, particularly Latinos, had obviously clearly preferred not to vote, had made a conscious decision not to vote, and that the negatives on both Simon, obviously, but also Davis, that were both over 60% negative of the people who voted, clearly suggested that this election wasn't done with, that people were not satisfied with it. It was the first time that California had ever deviated in turnout from the national mean in any significant degree. California's turnout for the off year was just a disastrous drop, as lowest in history. And the frustration from looking at the LA Times exit poll was very clear. I mean, people were really felt they had no choice, and they basically didn't. I mean, basically, the election was rigged during the Republican primary by Davis's entrance, spending $10 million against Reardon to try to get Simon nominated.
But how do you explain how stupid can the Republicans be to allow Gray Davis to pick their candidate?
Well, it was pretty stupid because at the time I couldn't understand it. It seemed to me that none of them were saying anything. It was, the problem with this is, of course, and as I said at the time, publicly, so I was outraged, because basically you have to remember something. We were now violating some very fundamental, nothing will stop Gray Davis. Gray Davis has no moral basis at all. I mean, the man is just unprincipled. He has no principles to worry about breaking. But the fact is, to cross over the line, and of course, with reapportionment here, where it's been called bipartisan apartheid, where, the voters, whether the electorate picks the politicians pick the voters, and we have no competitive elections. Well, the problem is, twice the voters voted for and confirmed their desire to have an open primary. Both parties, political parties, took that to the Supreme Court of the United States. The Supreme Court of the United States threw it out on the basis that it violated the right of parties to association to pick their candidates, which, of course, Davis going in the Republican, where he's not on the ballot, spending $10 million in the Republican primary, in disguising his ads, basically, so it was very unclear where they were coming from, was an act of violating that. And, of course, it's the sort of thing, now I expect this will, George Bush will now use that same precedent. And I predicted this at the time. He's got teeth and raise $200 million. He's going to use it in the spring and use that very same precedent against whoever he wants to rough up or knock out of the Democratic primaries.
Well, the rumor is that we hear that Karl Rove keeps saying, go Dean, go Dean.
Well, I think that Karl Rove is, listen, I was, in 1980, I was one of the people saying, go Reagan, go Reagan.
Well, that wasn't too smart, Pat.
Well, no, but it looked smart at the time.
Right.
I mean, Bush looked like a more serious problem at the time, and early in the spring, as Reagan was viewed as a very ideological candidate.
Right.
And Bush is a very moderate candidate. The fact is, Dean is not they can't figure Dean out. I mean, the problem is, it's the Washington problem. They can't figure out the phenomena here. And it's frightening, because basically it's an anti-establishment phenomenon. I mean, in many ways, the Dean movement is the voters carrying Dean rather than Dean moving them.
Right.
And it's because this anger, and I said this on television the other day, first of all, remember, the grassroots of the Democratic Party was upset, and visibly so, before Dean ever showed up on the radar scope. If you remember last year, during the time of the Iraq voting, starting in August, the grassroots Democrats stopped giving money, sending in small contributions and so forth. The DNC's fundraising collapsed. People were outraged because of what was happening on the Iraq war. And a lot of that still exists, or what they feel is a lack of opposition, which has been, an ineffective and lack of opposition to George Bush.
Well, surely, in retrospect, it's so clear that George Bush played them, and it's shameless that they rolled over for him.
Oh, it's unbelievable.
Particularly given that it turns out now we know that he was lying, both to them and to us.
You know, this is my point. Let us not forget that from March of 2000 to January of 2001, 2003, excuse me, the Democrats controlled the Senate. The Democrats controlled the Foreign Relations Committee. The Democrats controlled the Intelligence Committee. They were in a position. They had almost no... I'll tell you, my outrage about this is, just in looking at it, we didn't have the kind of extensive hearings about Iraq that we had in 1991, nor, by the way, I don't think there was ever any hearings by the Foreign Relations Committee about going after from June, from this West Point speech, the president's announcement of this preemptive war policy, which violates 200 and more than 200 years of American foreign policy doctrine and tradition and principles, or even this atomic weapons, the development of nuclear weapons, which came in the summer. All that was being put in writing. They were all putting it down in national security stuff. And I don't remember any extensive hearings or complaining. Problem with the Democratic Party is the party in Washington all it's been doing is trying to figure out how to be like him, just a little less.
Well, Pat,
it will work politically. There's been no principle there. They had the Senate. Now we have nothing, because basically, we have no opposition. We didn't have any opposition.
Pat Goodell, let's just return to California and to the recall. And you were saying earlier that at the time of the elections, you had predicted.
I said the Friday after. Now people are not going to be laughing. Somebody giggled on the show. I said, Bill Roosevelt's show. I said, you're not going to be laughing a year from now.
Well, but let's look at the logic of the recall, though. Wouldn't it be democratic and fair and that the people who voted in this last election, even though they were dissatisfied and many boycotted, as you mentioned, the recall shouldn't it be restricted to those who vote?
No, absolutely not.
Ian. Why?
Basically, because look, if in fact people were not, my argument, because remember, one of the most important things happening in this recall, and that's what was important, I kept pointing out last year, the Hispanics in this state, who should have been 18% of the electorate in the fall, mm-hmm. went back to the level they were in 1994. They are a majority of the Hispanics have been supporting the recall from the beginning, mainly because they're the ones getting screwed. No, I don't believe that because, in fact, people have been denied. We've basically had a, you know, a the very thing that Hiram Johnson and the progressives were concerned about in 1910 and 11, which was a basically a party-governed special interest state. That's why they put these measures in to stop that. To call what we had in California in 2000 an election is to call what's going on in Iraq the process of democracy. Mm-hmm. We had 153 assembly, state senate, and congressional races on the ballot. Five of them were competitive. One congressional race was competitive. 50 of the incumbents running for the Congress got over 60% of the vote. Why? Because the Democrats and Republicans went in the back room in Sacramento and made a deal that they would cut up the seats among them and they would keep it to the status quo, Democratic majority. The Democrats wouldn't move to take more and the Republicans wouldn't go to court, and nobody argued for the fact that we should have competitive elections. So what happens in these primaries? We get the kind of extremities because the special interests can control those closed primaries, which went along with, again, as I pointed out before, about closing the primary process again. So, no, wait a second. And Davis's intervention, but last fall, in the field poll by September, Reardon, as a write-in candidate, was beating Davis by 15 points. All you had to do was listen to the radio shows on this station, the letters there. People's anger at having to choose between this idiot, Simon, a fool had no business being in the race, and Davis, and that in his $78 million negative juggernaut. People didn't have a choice. And the fact of the matter is the recall was specifically, I've gone back and studied the history of this. It was to make sure, it was to stop this. The problem is that, nobody's updated it in all that time. But the recall provision was put in specifically to be able to break this kind of process, which we have in Sacramento. The most appalling thing to me are supposedly the Democrats I see who seem to hate democracy, and particularly when they're up there screwing, as they have been for years. All you have to do is the privacy bill, the mercury insurance bill that Harvey Rosenfeld's talked about, the giving away of the state, basically.
Well, look at the energy deregulation.
By the way, voted unanimously. $50 million spent by the three utility companies, and every single Democrat and every single Republican voted for it.
Well, Pat Goodell, though, still, how do you explain a situation in which the people who didn't vote in the last election appear to have more rights, and the people who's 8 million who voted for this guy, their rights are being overturned?
How can you say that? First of all, they don't have more rights. The fact is it's a statewide recall. By the way, we should understand about this recall, by the way, which I'll get to in a minute, because we don't understand the numbers and how big it really is. But the fact is that everybody, you can't just say people who voted have the right to do this. And by the way, I'm not sure I would be very interested to see a cross section of the people who did vote last year. I suspect they're in favor of this because the margin was only 5 points and they didn't like anybody. But for people who felt that they didn't have a choice, that it had been taken away from them, that essentially this is a rigged process, which it has been. This state has always had, the thing that made California great for 50 years was it basically had nonpartisan citizen government. That's what this state was number one at. Partisanship inside the state didn't matter. It was, I was reading John Gunther in 1946 writing in Inside USA about just how different California was at a time of party machines. What you then did is you had vision, you had the Pat Brown, whether it was Earl Warren or Pat Brown, whether you said the university system, the water, and look what happened last week, and no one has said anything. The master plan for education, what built this state's economy was its education, its higher education system. The master plan for education, it said every child in California, a graduate student who qualified, would find a place in the California system. At once you could go for free. Either the University of California system or the state colleges or community colleges. Now with the cuts in the budget, what they're doing, what they cut up, what they went after was that thousands of kids will be denied in the spring entry into the California system, which is might as well, I mean, that was the promise of California, and its throat was slit right in front of us. Meanwhile, while the money exiting out, going, for instance, to the employee unions who have the state by a stranglehold,
Particularly the prison guards.
The prison guards, the money going there, the robbing of this thing for special interest, the Democrats, the liberal. Well, all you had to do is listen to Miss Jackie Goldberg and her friends and their little conversation caught off tape. We don't have people are this. And by the way, this isn't just California. This thing is very. What's going on with Dean is not. Is connected in very many ways for very somewhat different reasons. It's the same kind of phenomena. People are very angry. They have no voice in this country. And that what set off, and let me just say this about the recall. So let's understand this. Mr. ICE's money was not the only money. The paid, there are now 2.2 million people who sent in petitions, by the way, because they keep coming into to Ted Costa's office every day. Because I was curious about this, I was exploring it. 900,000 petitions were gathered by paid signature people. 1.3 million have come in either volunteers or others. And when they did a sampling, I talked to this guy, the professor, did this. I don't know why they never reported this. They've got 500,000 more signatures sitting in Sacramento at their office. The other thing is that 40%, when they did a sampling of the background on the people who signed petitions, 40% of them were Democrats. And what drove this was not just the money. What drove this was the car tax. The week before the car, June 20th, that week of June 20th, they had submitted a little less than 400,000 official signatures. They had 700,000 because they were still processing their own. Between June 20th and the end of the 4th of July weekend, that number went up to 1.65 million. And what was driving it was the car tax. And it was, you know, which will, you know, was basically people felt were outraged at the idea that they could just administratively do it, which apparently is illegal. It would probably be ruled so by the courts, the experts say.
Pat, let's just in the last minute then turn to obviously just in terms of pure numbers and democracy, there's something troublesome about the idea that in the recall, if Davis got 49% but couldn't stop the recall and go to the second page and the person who wins only gets 10%, that is profoundly undemocratic.
Well, the problem that's undemocratic is the Secretary of State using what is clearly called an legally not ruled for, specifically it's not supposed to apply to recall, which is to qualify for the ballot.
Right.
And the centering on this, by the way, the way they did it, made this thing, you know, kind of a spectacle to enjoy. First of all, though, remember, Davis didn't win with 50%. We don't have a 50% runoff capacity in the state. He only got 47% last time. You know, third parties were at the high. He won by 5 points over Simon. Peter Cameo and the other third party and nonpartisan candidates got 11% total, the highest in history in the state. The fact is, you know, the problem is having this, because you don't have primaries, this blanket number of people running, but I think that's not going to happen. I think that what we'll end up doing is it'll end up getting centered around a few candidates before it's over, one way or the other.
Well, particularly Arnold Schwarzenegger.
I'm not so sure about that.
You don't think so?
Well, first of all, if Schwarzenegger is going to run as a Pete Wilson Republican, you know, he's going to cut his throat. You know,
Pete Wilson's his mentor.
Well, no, he's not his mentor. His people,
well,
he's got
close.
All his people. But I mean, yeah, he looks at, you know, he's a supporter. Wilson was basically. The problem is that the Democratic Party's attitude that and the progressives that you are not supposed to have any choice here. As the unions say, we run this. By the way, the unions are violent about keeping Dianne Feinstein off the ballot. You know, if you read LA Weekly this week and Harold Meyerson's column, because you know they can't control her. They didn't want her on the ballot. I mean, the fact is that, you know, this what we have here is, meanwhile, every day in the paper, you got one scandal after another going on in front of us, and nobody's standing up so far for California. It's all the Democrats own. This is our governorship. The Republicans say, well, no, we want to take it now, and we find a way to do this. And what is missing is the people who signed this recall, the people in the state of California, they happen to think it belongs to them, and they would like to get it back before we all go underwater, which is where we're headed.
But if you think it's a bad idea, this recall...
I don't think it's a bad idea.
You don't. I see. So that...
I happen to believe in democracy. I happen to believe that, in fact, I believe in the sovereignty of the people, not the sovereignty of political bosses or parties. And it's one of the reasons I got out of politics, because of the corruption in it. And what we have is let me just tell you, I go around telling people, we have this example, we will have... One of the things that's being cut in school budgets locally is our school buses. By the way, because they're not mandated by law. School transportation is not mandated by state law. It's one of the few things they're not. So all over the state, you have transportation, school buses being cut out. Well, I went and had the numbers checked. Between 1995 and 2001, over 200 California children were killed going to school or coming home from school by walking, driving, you know, riding bicycles or in other vehicles. Three were fatalities in school bus accidents. we cut that stuff. You know, kids are going to die, just like they're dying in the, you know, because people are dying because they can't get health care and having to wait, you know, while you have 500 employees of the county government of L.A. who have cars paid for, gas paid for, insurance paid for private use by the taxpayers. You know, at what point do the people, you know, this state is on the verge of bankruptcy. And with this pension problem, with this latest budget will be, and the idea that we're supposed to sit around and wait while this thing goes under. You know, the people are supposed to, I suppose, be in steerage, as I say, on the Titanic, and let, you know, with the gates locked, you know, as they go down. People don't believe in that. And this is, I think that this, I'm just disappointed that there are not, that too many progressive people who claim to be progressives are so anti-democratic and so willing to defend the indefensible, like Gray Davis and that administration, and what it's done to the very constituencies that we're supposed to be for, who by the way, got it. The Hispanics aren't voting because they're the people being screwed. Their kids are being screwed in schools, the air, all of the stuff going on in the state.
Right, but do you think, realistically, though, Pat, do you think a progressive's got a chance in this election?
Well, no, I think what's unclear to me yet is whether or not what I've said from the very beginning is what people want to do is they want to go, what they want to do is we should go back to what made this state great, which is bipartisan, nonpartisan government. What I'm waiting to see is whether somebody is going to put together, which is, and I've talked to people who would be willing to support it, a bipartisan government, a commitment to bipartisan cabinet, nonpartisan cabinet of the best people, and a set of principles, an agreement to a set of principles that people can agree with without reference to party on the big questions in the state.
Right, well, they can't even pass a budget because of the two-thirds requirement.
Well, but that's, no, you can't pass a budget. It's not the two-thirds, Ian. You can't pass a budget because all the Republicans elected under this non-democracy we have, this political apartheid system, are all extreme right-wingers who are in fear of their lives in the right wing, and all the Democrats are owned by special interest Democratic groups, and they just, and you know, and they won't cut any spending at all, no matter what it is. You've got, that's why you can't get two-thirds.
Uh-huh.
This is bullshit. Pardon my language on the radio, but that is absolutely ridiculous to say that it's because of the two-thirds rule. We've had two-thirds for a law for years. We did it in the 1990s when it was really first very bad. You know, Willie Brown and Pete Wilson, Democrats and Republicans, but Democrats controlled the Assembly and the Senate. I mean, they were able to finally put something together because it was a responsibility. Back in the 50s and 60s, in the early 70s, actually since, you know, the 1940s, that's how California worked. You know, there's a sense of responsibility and vision, and not simply to people's own political careers or to whatever whatever they can bargain out of the government because they have some control of it.
Well, Pat, I thank you very much for joining us.
Okay. Thanks, Ian. Bye.
Bye. Hello again. I'm Ian Masters. I'm speaking then with Pat Caddell, who's a former Democratic pollster who worked for President Carter and is a regular on MSNBC. I'm now speaking with Jackie Cabasso, the author of The End of Disarmament and The Arms Race to Come. And Jackie, you're on your way to Livermore to organize a demonstration today in front of the Lawrence Livermore Lab, founded by Edward Teller after he didn't get his way with Los Alamos. It's essentially a designer shop for a ideologically driven weaponeer, and it seems like we're back to that idea that a few ideologues can use science to create weapons that affect policy.
That's correct. In fact, I'm just now parking my car at the rally site. Livermore Lab actually was established in 1952 as an internal competitor, that is internal within the United States, with Los Alamos Lab to see which laboratory would be the first to develop a hydrogen bomb. And so in that sense, the direct descendants of the Manhattan Project are still enormously powerful political institutions, and the arms race between them has continued despite the end of the Cold War and despite all the profound world changes over the last 10 years.
Do you think the average American understands that we are actually spending more on nuclear weapons today than we were in the Cold War?
I absolutely don't think they do. And I think if they did know that, you know, perhaps there might be some change. I don't think that Americans would approve of that if they understood what was going on.
Well, the idea that there was this peace dividend, this drawdown, I mean, there has been nuclear disarmament. There's no question that they're taking weapons out of the inventory and now they're burning all the chemical munitions. But for some reason or other, the nuclear weapons lobby managed to work it that they still get a huge amount of money for a so-called stockpile stewardship. But now they want more. They actually want to get back into making new weapons. And, of course, when you make new weapons, you have to test them. And that's the threshold that I imagine is going to be crossed.
Well, what's that? Stockpile Stewardship, the program that you referred to, is the euphemistic name for the laboratory testing program that was put in place under the Clinton administration to provide the technological means to allow the nuclear weapons designers to continue with their research and development, even if the United States entered into a comprehensive test ban treaty. This was supposedly a strategy to get the Senate to ratify the comprehensive test ban treaty, and they were told that with stockpile stewardship, the United States would be able to pull the technological ladder up to its, up behind itself and maintain its nuclear superiority even without nuclear testing. This strategy totally backfired. The Senate didn't ratify the treaty. The deal revealed to the rest of the world that the United States was not the least bit serious about implementing its obligations under the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty, which obligates the United States to eliminate its nuclear arsenal through good faith negotiations, and which actually has been U.S. law, binding on the U.S., since 1970. And so what we have now is a massively expanded nuclear weapons research and development program, $6 billion a year now, not including delivery systems. We have advanced weapons concept teams that have been reestablished at the laboratories. We have research going on into the development of lower yield, more usable in the parlance of the military nuclear weapons with special capabilities such as burrowing into the earth before detonating. They're also looking at, in that regard, a very high yield, so-called robust nuclear earth penetrator that would be designed to smash through 20 or 30 feet of rock before exploding, and which would cause a huge, deadly radioactive mushroom cloud. And all of this is being done in the context of a nuclear policy, which, as has been revealed through the Nuclear Posture Review, the National Security Strategy of the United States, and the National Strategy to Combat Weapons of Mass Destruction, is contemplating an expanded role for nuclear weapons, with the idea that nuclear weapons are now just one tool in the toolkit, one part of the arsenal that will allow the United States to project overwhelming military force anytime it wants to, anywhere in the world, for any reason.
Yes, Jackie Cabasa, yesterday, August the 9th, was the anniversary of the last use of a nuclear weapon, the last time a nuclear shot was fired in anger. What the proponents...
By the United States.
By the United States, yeah. Well, I think nobody's really... They've used them since then.
You have to remind people that, though.
Yeah, but the bottom line is that those who believe that the Cold War was won through deterrence, and that the fact that we haven't had a nuclear weapon used since Nagasaki is a virtue. Now, I've looked into the record. We just got lucky, frankly. We it came close to a number of times to all-out nuclear war, but that's another story. The bottom line is you can't have it both ways. If you think that this is what's kept the peace, and then you start going down this road where you're actually going to use them and then just another weapon in the inventory, that is absolute insanity.
Well, I certainly agree with you, and I want to substantiate what you were saying about being lucky. That's also what General Lee Butler said, and he was actually the head of the Strategic Command in charge of all U.S. nuclear forces through the Gulf War, and that's what he said. We were lucky. We've been lucky. But I maintain that if the most powerful military force in the history of the planet, which is the United States, and the only country that has ever used nuclear weapons, asserts that it reserves for itself the right to threaten nuclear attack against anybody who it feels threatened by for any reason, then other countries are going to follow its example. This is an absolutely unsustainable policy of national security. It is a recipe for endless arms racing, for endless wars, and probably for nuclear weapons use at some point, unless we move decisively in the other direction and radically redefine security, not in the national terms in which it's being discussed now, but in terms of human and ecological security for everybody.
Let me ask you a difficult question. What would you do about the Iranians, who apparently are much closer to a nuclear bomb than anybody thought?
I would do as I say and not as I do. The issue with Iran is that under the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty, Iran, as a declared non-nuclear weapon state, has a right to have nuclear power, in fact, has been promised assistance with nuclear power. And what's at issue now is whether Iran is using its nuclear power plants in a clandestine fashion to make nuclear weapons. Well, therein lies the first part of the problem. The United States has been a major proponent and exporter of nuclear power technology. Furthermore, under the Non-Proliferation Treaty, Iran actually is in compliance with the International Atomic Agency safeguards. That is, the inspectors are coming in and inspecting, and we'd like to expand those inspections. But at the same time, the United States, under the Biological Weapons Convention, is blocking adoption of a protocol that would allow weapons inspectors into U.S. facilities, including here at Livermore Lab, by the way, where they are doing biowarfare research, to find out what's going on. So the United States is at every corner ignoring and violating its own international law obligations, making sure that it is exempt from the kinds of inspections and standards that it is setting for other countries, and then threatening to use nuclear weapons against those countries. So we have to really go back to the drawing board on these policies, and we have to stop acting in such an incredibly hypocritical manner, observe our own treaty obligation, then we will be in a much stronger position with much greater international support to try to dissuade other countries from following in what are now our footsteps. It's a complicated problem, but we're making it worse with our policies. Mm.
But still, if it looks likely that in, you know, a year or so Iran tests a nuclear weapon, what can we do? What can anybody do? And what can anybody do to
we should start talking with Iran. In fact, we should start talking with all of the other nuclear weapons states about implementing a plan to get rid of our nuclear weapons, all of us, all together, all at the same time.
Heavens forbid.
We should stop. Also, it would help if we stopped threatening Iran with a nuclear attack. You know, Iran is named as part of the axis of evil. Iran is named, is a country that fits the criteria to be preemptively attacked by the United States, including with nuclear weapons under the Nuclear Policy Review and the other documents that I referred to. Iran has every reason to feel threatened by the United States. Perhaps if they didn't feel threatened, they wouldn't feel the need to defend themselves. Well, this is exactly what I'm talking about. We are perpetuating this endless cycle of escalating violence.
Well, I was going to say, heavens forbid that we set an example. I mean,
well,
isn't that
it
what
it would be nice if we did, wouldn't it?
That seems to be the only hope for a world not gone mad. I think
we have to. You know, the standard is not a perfect world. The standard of comparison is the world we live in right now.
Sure.
And will we be better or worse off if we take some leadership in making good on our treaty obligations and leading the world away from the nuclear precipice? I think that's the question.
I thank you for joining us in Los Angeles from Los Alamos, from Lawrence Livermore, Jackie Cabasa.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. Just speaking then with Jackie Cabasa, the author of The End of Disarmament and The Arms Race to Come, and she's outside of Lawrence Livermore Laboratories, where there is going to be apparently substantial demonstration today against the United States progressing into an area of building nuclear weapons that could be usable, that are designed to be used rather than for deterrence purposes, which has been the history of the arms race. I thank Mark Maxwell, the engineer, and Lewis Vandenberg for research and production help. This program can be heard at any time on ianmasters.org, where previous programs are archived.